And this is Truth Quest with Melody, and this is KHEN LP FM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado. Just to make sure I got it out there, you know, and what station you're listening to. And my co-host this evening is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and he's back to do an interview with me with Ellen Brown. And Ellen Brown developed her research skills as an attorney practicing civil litigation in Los Angeles. In The Web of Debt, her latest book, she turns those skills to an analysis of the Federal Reserve and the money trust. She shows how this private cartel has usurped the power to create money from the people themselves and how we the people can get it back. Brown developed an interest in the developing world and its problems while living abroad for 11 years in Kenya, Honduras, Guatemala, and Nicaragua. She returned to practicing law when she was asked to join the legal team of a popular Tijuana healer with an innovative cancer therapy who was targeted by the chemotherapy industry in the 1990s. That experience produced her book, Forbidden Medicine, which traces the suppression of natural health treatments to the same corrupting influences that have captured the money system. Ellen's 11 books include the best-selling Nature's Pharmacy, co-authored by Dr. Lynn Walker, which has sold 285,000 copies. Ellen and Dr. Carlstrom, are you there?
Yep.
Yes, you know, Melody, I can hear Ellen very well, but I can just barely hear you.
Okay.
Is it possible to have you turned up a little bit?
Well, let's see if we can try it here. Is that any better?
Can you say something again?
Is that
yeah, that's better. Thank
okay.
you.
All right.
Yeah.
So, Eric, would you like to go ahead and start?
Well, yeah, thank you. I would like to go ahead. Just a couple weeks ago, Melody and I were joined by William T. Still, who has a recent movie out called The Secret of Oz. And this is the same guy who put together the DVD, or excuse me, I guess it was a video, VCR, on the Money Master. So he wrote a book on that topic called On the Horns of the Beast, the Federal Reserve and the New World Order. Anyway, Bill Still interviews Ellen Brown in his movie The Secret of Oz, and I happen to have her book here, The Web of Debt, and it happens to be the very first chapter. She talks about the Wizard of Oz and the symbology behind the Wizard of Oz as a way to start to understand the mess we're in with our financial system. And then she's talking about, of course, the messages that Frank L. Baum put in his story, The Wizard of Oz, around the 1900. So, Ellen, welcome, would you mind just kind of starting off on that topic with us and explaining why everyone relates to The Wizard of Oz? Could you just explain briefly why that's an important story, allegory for the situation we're in?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I love the story myself. That's why I started. I mean, it was so interesting when I discovered that it was actually written as a monetary allegory in the 1890s. It's got two themes running through it, besides the children's story. One is this allegory of the money reform movement of the 1890s. There was a populist movement to take back the money power, something we should be doing today. We should have that very same movement right now. That's what we need, is a grassroots movement to get back the power to create our own money. Right now, we've given that away to the bankers. But in the 1890s, there was a depression that was pretty close to as bad as the Great Depression in the 1930s. In 1893, and in 1894, there was the march of a group of greenbackers, as they were called, on Washington to petition the Congress to go back to the greenback system of Abraham Lincoln, where the government would issue the money instead of borrowing from the British bankers, which is what Lincoln's alternative when he started out the war was because he didn't have the money to fight the war, was to either borrow from the British bankers at usurious interest rates, 24% to 36%. That's what they were requiring of him, or to print his own money, which is what he did. And in that way, the North won the war. They escaped being debt slaves to the British, or at least for the time being. And so that's what this March on Washington was all about. It was the first ever March on Washington, so it was definitely a newsworthy event. And the Wizard of Oz plot line is modeled after that. If you think about it, it's a very strange plot for a children's story. You have this group of people, or semi-people, group of beings, who are marching off to the capital city, Oz, to petition this great wizard, who is actually, it turns out to be a little man turning knobs and dials behind a curtain, to get relief from their grievances. Well, that was this March on Washington, seeking a return to expand the money supply, in other words, to cure the depression by getting more money out there. And you would get the money out there by allowing the government to print money. The leader of that group was Jacob Coxey, and his plan, which he said came to him in a dream, was that the government would print. Well, he had two bills. One was called the Good Roads Bill. So they would print dollars, U.S. notes, and pay workers and materials to build roads, and this would help the farmers because they were sort of beholden to the railroads at that time, and that was one reason that they were being squeezed out of the market. The railroad was the Rockefeller Morgan cartel, which were also the bankers. And then his other bill would have allowed the states to borrow. You'd have issues of greenbacks, which would be lent to the states interest-free. So those are both brilliant ideas, and we should be doing that today. I mean, we should pick up where he left off and use his ideas. So that was one theme, and then the other theme, of course, was this idea that you have what you want all along, that you already have it, and that was a theosophical idea. It was a new movement in the 1890s. The Theosophical movement was imported from India, the whole Indian philosophy, and under Indian or cosmology, you are what you think, or you create your own reality. It's also the Christian message, you know, that be it unto you according to your belief. But so there you had the scarecrow already had a brain, and the lion already had courage and so forth. But you could extend that to say that the country already had the abundance that it was seeking. All they needed was a symbol of abundance. The symbols, you know, the lion got a symbol of a heart, and the scarecrow got a symbol of a brain, etc. The diploma for the scarecrow, et cetera. So the symbol of abundance for the country would be paper money that you would issue in order to pay for all the projects that you wanted to develop, pay the workers, pay the materials, build the things, and get the economy going again.
Yeah, just to kind of finish the symbolism in the story. As I recall, the scarecrow does represent the farmer who, you know, people think is kind of dim-witted, but really he knows what's going on. He's a pretty sharp guy. The Tin Man is the industrial worker who's kind of lost his heart because he's now a cog in the machine. He's not an artisan anymore. The Cowardly Lion symbolizes a politician of the time, William Jennings Bryan, who was this fiery orator who in 1896 at the Democratic Convention said, you will not crucify America on a cross of gold. And he was talking about the gold standard. And, of course, the bankers were the ones who were sticking it to America by enforcing the gold standard. And to take the symbolism further, the Wicked Witch of the West was the Rockefeller Syndicate, the bankers. The Wicked Witch of the East is the Morgan bankers, I gather, and then the Wizard would be more or less the president. The Yellow Brick Road would be the gold standard itself. And then Dorothy would be representing, I guess, America and its potential. And in the original story, she didn't have ruby slippers. She had silver slippers, and the silver slippers represented the power of America to print its own money or to monetize silver in that case, so that they wouldn't be kind of shafted by the manipulations of the wicked witches and the bankers. Is that would you have something to add to those symbols there, Ellen?
Yeah, that's great. That was it. Dorothy also represented. I only learned this after I'd written my first edition, so I put it in my 2010 edition. There was a woman who was a fiery leader. Her name was Mary Ellen Leese, and she was an orator. And she'd gotten into politics when her husband lost his farm to. She was from Kansas. It was a Kansas farm, and they lost it to the Wall Street bankers. And so that's what motivated her for the rest of her life. And she had four kids, and the story was that while she was doing her housework, she decided she was going to be a lawyer. So she was doing the washing on the washboard, and she pinned her papers up on the clothesline. So she was studying for her bar exam while she was washing her clothes. So she's very determined, an inspirational role model. And she gave this one speech that she said, "Wall Street owns the country." I mean, it was a speech that you could give today. They were talking about the very same things, that about how the bankers had taken over, and that the farmers were insisting on, or that this populist movement, they were insisting on taking back the power to create money. They wanted publicly owned banks, not these private banks that were parasitizing the economy. And they wanted the power to issue the money as a government asset and not as a private banker asset.
Yeah, maybe, of course, at that time, what would be the time period when this lady was speaking and writing?
She 1890, so she was actually before the March on...
Before the March on Washington, which is before the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which finally gave the power to print the money to this cartel of international bankers. So in 1913, which is actually after Frank Baum wrote The Wizard of Oz, the coup de grace was consummated, I guess you could say, in the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, which some would say was one of the greatest crimes in American history, when a small group of private individuals established the Federal Reserve and their right to print the money out of nothing and then charge interest on it by loaning it to the government. So rather than having the government print money interest-free, now this small group of individuals, many of whom are European bankers, in fact, like you say, British, now has the power to control the quantity of money in the economy and the interest rates chargeable on that money. And many would have said that this gave them essentially the control of the entire economy of the country, and we've been there ever since. Would you agree with that, or can you tell us what a central bank is? Maybe most people don't know that the Federal Reserve is a central bank, and they don't know what the Federal Reserve is.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll just say one interesting point. William Jennings Bryan, who was the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz, who was the populist leader of 1896 and again 1900, he was the candidate for president that almost made it. It was the last time we had a strong third-party candidate who got that close to becoming president. He led the opposition to the Federal Reserve Act in 1913. He said absolutely there was no way that he and his group would approve a bill that was going to authorize the Wall Street bankers to have control of our money. And so it was originally called the Aldrich Bill. So the drafters of that bill, who were Aldrich and the Morgan and Rockefeller group, they changed the name of the bill to the Federal Reserve Act, making it look federal. and it was so obscurely worded that William Jennings Bryan couldn't even tell that it hadn't given the power to create money to the government. So he was all excited, and he thought that they had won, and he said, you know, we won. At last, the power to create money is given to the people. But that wasn't it. So it was years later before people even realized what had happened here. And the 16th Amendment was passed at the same time, which instituted the income tax, federal income tax. And again, it didn't have much impact at first. It's like today, you know, where they pass these laws and they kind of mellow for a while. And then years later, suddenly they come into effect, and it's been on the books for so long that you can't really change it. So the income tax at first was just, it only affected a few people, and it was hardly used, and nobody worried about it. But then later, obviously, it became a great tool, and the whole point of it was to have a source of money to pay the interest that was going to be due to the Federal Reserve for creating our money and lending it to us. And it wasn't until the 1960s that Wright Patman, who was head of the House Banking and Currency Committee, realized all that and said, you all are printing our money and lending it to us at interest. That's not right. You should be nationalized, or the Federal Reserve should be nationalized, which it wasn't. But the Federal Reserve, in order to remain independent, agreed to rebate the interest to the government after deducting their costs. So that's where we are today. But anyway, the whole evolution of the thing was just one deception after another. And now I've forgotten what your question was.
Well, I was just asking you to explain what the Federal Reserve was and what is a central bank. Now, uh-huh. About 190 countries exist, and I think just all but two or three of them have private central banks. So the situation that we're in is not unique. if you could just explain what the Federal Reserve is. As I understand it, it's not federal, and there are no reserves. I'm just kind of thinking in terms of setting the groundwork for our listeners, because most people are pretty fuzzy on these things.
Mm-hmm. A central bank actually is there to serve the banks. The Federal Reserve was set up, and other central banks were set up, because in the 19th century you had wave after wave of bank runs. The way banking works, that the banks would hold currencies were then backed by gold. So the banks would hold some amount of gold, and then they issued these paper banknotes, which they were allowed to do. It had their own name on it, whatever bank it was, and it represented a certain sum of gold. But they lent many times more paper notes than they had gold. So that they had early on figured out that they could issue up to 10 times as many notes as they had gold and get away with it, because people only came for their gold about 10% of the time. And so, of course, gold is fungible, so they could use the same gold for whoever came for it would get the gold. And so periodically, people would figure out that there wasn't enough gold. They'd get nervous about the banks, and then they'd all rush to the bank at once to demand their gold, and then the bank would have to close its doors, and you'd have a depression, and the farmers would, or the people would lose their homes and farms to the banks. And so that cycle kept repeating. So the function of the central bank was to provide the reserves so that that wouldn't happen. It would be, if a bank got in trouble, it could borrow from this central bank, which would have the power to issue money directly, to create it on their books as credit, and then issue it to the bank, and then the bank would have to pay it back when it could.
And so, as I understand it, the Federal Reserve was structured on the model of the Bank of England, which goes way back into the 1690s or something like that. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the Bank of England actually is technically owned by the government. It was nationalized in 1946. When there was a labor government that was agitating to either get rid of it or nationalize it, so they nationalized it. But it's still actually privately controlled. You know, it's like there's not that much difference between the publicly owned Bank of England and the privately owned Federal Reserve. They're both controlled by the bankers. They retain their independence. In fact, the Bank of England became got more independent with Gordon Brown in the 1990s was, I think he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, and he made it so that it was an independent body, and which means that the government couldn't really control it. That the Fed would tell the the Bank of England, the central bank would tell the government what's happening instead of the government telling the central bank. So that's what we have too. That's what they all have. Even though some of the central banks are nominally government owned, but they're still independent.
Well, while we're on this topic, I think maybe we should bring up the city of London, which is, like Washington, D.C. and the Vatican, a small piece of territory within the other city of London, which is comprised, I think, of something like 12 central banks, and is an independent nation. It's not actually part of Great Britain. And when the Queen goes to the city of London, she has to bend down on her, she has to curtsy or whatever, and show fealty or whatever to the head honcho of the banks there. Could you say a little bit about the city of London? There's an excellent book that came out in the 40s, basically saying the city of London runs the world, most people haven't really heard of the city of London, but maybe you have a perspective on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was just writing about the Commonwealth Bank of Australia in the 1920s. During the 19th century, when originally, of course, England had all these colonies, and so they literally colonized these countries and made the countries ship cotton and other wares to England, which then England would make into manufactured goods. And then when the colonies got independence, the way they controlled them was through the city of London, through the bankers. The banks would make loans the countries of the Commonwealth were still dependent on England because of this whole lending system. So then there was that huge depression in the 1890s that was global, and it was particularly bad in Australia. 1893, the banks just closed, and people couldn't get their money at all, and there was no welfare of any kind. There was no unemployment insurance, no FDIC insurance, no Social Security. So it was a huge disaster. People were jumping off of bridges and throwing themselves in front of trains. And so their solution in Australia was to set up a publicly owned bank, which I think is the solution even now. It was the Commonwealth Bank of Australia. And it was initiated in 1911, the bill was passed in 1911. I think it was opened its doors in 1912. And interestingly, the first governor was a banker himself, and he knew how banking worked. And he set this bank up without any capital. He started it out he operated it just on the credit of the country. So he was basically just lending credit. And with that credit, he built huge amounts of infrastructure over the next 8 years. Not only did they build a lot of infrastructure at very low interest to the government, but they funded World War I, basically on the public credit. So it worked brilliantly well. And in the 1920s, then the Bank of England and the bankers, or not the Bank of the City of London and the bankers, were quite alarmed at this, because if the colonies all figured, or the Commonwealth countries all figured out that they could be independent of England and issue their own money and their own credit, then England would lose these countries that it was dependent on for its raw materials. So they got back in control over the Commonwealth Bank, and they tightened the money supply everywhere and basically caused the Great Depression of the 1930s. The advantage of a depression to the banks, well, what a depression is when you collapse the money supply, you contract the amount of money that's out there. So if there's not enough money to pay for If you've got less money than goods and services, if you've got less money than your GDP, then you have to borrow. You have to make up that difference by borrowing, and that's how the banks stay in control, is they always want to keep a tight rein on the money supply. They don't want it to inflate. You know, they use that bad word, inflation. They don't want the money supply to inflate to where it would actually match the GDP, because then people wouldn't have to borrow from the banks.
Well, I'll just interject that the book that I was mentioning is called The Empire of the city being in quotations, The Jekyll Hyde Nature of the British Government by E.C. Knuth, K-N-U-T-H, a small book with a lot of information written in 1946 and then re-released in 1983. But basically, yeah, what you're speaking of is, of course, after World War II, or actually before that, the British Empire started falling apart, and these former colonies became part of what is now the British Commonwealth. We talked to Joan Vion on our show with Melody here, and she talks about how these 54 former colonies, Commonwealth countries, now all always vote with England on the United Nations, with United Nations, and they have to, more or less, by financial arrangements. So, in a sense, England or Great Britain is still has much more power than any other single country within the United Nations, which is, of course, one of the reasons why they're so pro United Nations, because it's going to often be doing their bidding. But yeah, your explanation is great about the role of these. In effect, what happened to Australia in the 1920s is what would happen if Dorothy clicked her silver slippers together and Americans realized that they can print their own money debt-free. Isn't that correct?
Exactly, yeah, and that's what had the bankers so alarmed. And that is the plot line for the last 300 years, that you've got this private banking cartel trying to get control of governments by issuing the money, and then opposing that is the ability of governments and the people they represent to issue their own money and issue their own credit. These two competing systems, and they really don't want us to know. That's the thing, there's suppression of information, so that we think we have to have those bankers. I mean, we think they're too big to fail. We think we've got to support this banking system, but we don't. We could set up our own separate banking system. Greece could set up its own credit system without even pulling out of the EU. They could just set up their own publicly owned banks, just like Australia did, and solve their credit crisis.
Do you see that as happening? Do you think that's a possibility? Do you think that somebody in Greece knows this?
Well, actually, somebody in Greece wrote to me and wanted help setting something up. I'm afraid I'm way overextended, so I haven't really followed up on that, but it's a definite possibility. Well, in the Lisbon Treaty, there's a clause that says that member countries may not borrow from their own central banks, which is really, it's really rather disastrous for the EU countries, because that means nobody can issue, they're not allowed to actually issue euros, you know, only the European Monetary Union or the European Central Bank can issue the euros. But anyway, under that clause, it says this does not apply to other government-owned banks, which will be treated just as ordinary private banks. So that means you could still have government-owned banks, not the central bank, but let's say you could set up what are called development banks, and through that, and then the development bank could issue credit, and in euros, you know, you don't even have to go back to drachmas, or don't have to do anything radical like pull out of the EU, but just issue credit in euros, and you don't even need the euros, you know, it's just credit, it's like checks, it's checkbook money, and then with that money you pay your workers and materials and get the economy going again, hire all those people that are out of work, go back to put all those services back on that have had to be slashed. So,
let me interject that this is Truth Quest with Melody and with my co-host Dr. Carlstrom, and our guest this evening is Ellen Brown, who's written the book Web of Debt, And it's The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. But I haven't... Wait. Go ahead, Melody. I want to hear from you.
Well...
Could you speak up, Melody? I really can't hear you.
Okay. What I would... You know, one of the things that I keep hearing many people who are addressing these issues talking about various systems to solve the money problem. But to me, if we don't hold anyone accountable for the corruption that's taking place within the system, it seems like somebody always comes up with a new and different way to... you know, break it. So, you know, even with the background of what you're coming up with for answers, do you address this?
Well, I see your point, but I really don't know how we can do very much at the congressional level. The Congress itself is deadlocked, and, I mean, you can just see, that, like you say, you can see them getting away with murder. Goldman Sachs got paid 100 cents on the dollar by AIG, and who negotiated that deal? Henry Paulson, who was from Goldman Sachs, and Lloyd Blankfein was sitting in on those meetings. I mean, there's a law that says it's a conflict of interest. It says it's illegal for those people to be sitting in on meetings where their own financial interests are being determined. Or when Bear Stearns was allegedly bailed out, they were actually bled to death, or it was actually a hostile takeover by J.P. Morgan. Well, the CEO of J.P. Morgan sat in on those meetings, and that's illegal. But there's nobody with the power to prosecute them. I mean, meanwhile, you see Maxine Waters, I see it, is just now she's going to get prosecuted for some something she did that favored some investment that her husband had, because Maxine Waters is a little person who actually dared to challenge Goldman Sachs. But the big people on top, nobody can challenge them.
Maxine Waters is one of the very few Congress persons who questioned what was going on with 911.
Yeah, so she was bold, and she has to be silenced. And so they can go after her and her conflicts of interest, which are far, far smaller. I mean, we're talking, I think it was his investment was $200,000, not these multi-billions that, Goldman Sachs' interest was, they got $13 billion out of AIG, 100 cents on the dollar, on derivatives. I mean, it wasn't even like, it was just a gamble, and they got to get fully paid on their bet. So it is clearly criminal, but how you can get to that, I don't know. So for me, the place to start is at the state level by setting up state-owned banks. We have one state that has its own bank, North Dakota. It's the only state that has a budget surplus when all the rest are now struggling, like California is virtually bankrupt. So I think we kind of have to start at the grassroots level, you know, or start as close to home as where we still have some influence, and then work up. Because if you try to go to the top, we just don't have the power at the moment. The way we can get the power is to set up our own. We can ignore them, you know, set up a better mousetrap, and then when everybody sees that they're not too big to fail and we don't need them, then we can go after them criminally or whatever. And there won't be any repercussions because we don't need their banking system.
Well, that's one of the interesting parts about the whole thing, and I hope this kind of ties in with the Wizard of Oz situation, is that, you know, since it is made up, then we are we have everything we need without them, and possibly some of the biblical aspects of being able to have a jubilee to forgive debt. I mean, they take our savings, and that's for debt, and yet at the same time we should be able to just walk away from them since it's made up money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know that it's the answer, but I'm just saying that there's some aspects there that to empower ourselves to realize that we may have more answers there if we start realizing that they aren't what they claim they are.
Well, yeah, when you say made up money, I think what you mean is fiat currency.
Right.
So, yeah, we have, ever since we dropped the gold standard under Nixon in, I think, 1972, the money has not been pegged to any essential commodity, so it's just kind of, the value is kind of floating, so it's a fiat currency. And I think Bill Still told us that fiat means that the government's kind of putting its reputation behind it or something like that. So it's only the fact that the government says it's worth something, then we believe that. Yeah, Ellen?
Well, on a jubilee, it seems to me there are two different types of debt out there. And so you don't want to forgive them all because ordinary loans where, like, people buy bonds or that's our money that we have lent to somebody else, and we really have a legal right to get that back. And it's no more fair to cancel the debt of the debtor than the other way around, because the creditor actually advanced his own money. But the other kind of debt is the one that where it's a bank created debt, because the banks do simply create that money on their books. So the way you could get rid of the debt without hurting anybody, let's say third world debt, you know, these big loans made by banks to third world countries for projects that they didn't really need, and then the interest rate was jacked up to 20%, and there was no way they could ever get out of debt. It just kept snowballing up. Well, those debts are owed, let's say a debt owed to the IMF or World Bank or whatever, those debts are owed to banks, and all you have to do is just ignore that side of the book that says, in other words, you can write it off. If the law allowed the bank to write it off without having to close its doors or without having to declare bankruptcy or something, this is what they do in China all the time. The Chinese banks just write this stuff off because originally the Chinese government owned everything, and so their banks were merely, it was all just accounting tools. So they'd figured out, well, they were just keeping track of how much money they spent for, you know, this factory and that factory and how much the factory produced. And if it produced more than they spent on it, well, great. But if it didn't, it was still just numbers on a screen, you know, so they just wrote that off. And nobody was hurt because there was nobody lost money on the deal. I mean, you could say it's inflationary, but the Chinese economy is so very productive that they have the goods and services to balance out this excess money that's out there.
In your book, Ellen, you talk about petrodollars, and I think maybe that's worth talking about a little bit. Could you say something about how there has been kind of an informal pegging of the value of the U.S. dollar to oil prices, and that this has been the international standard then for money?
Mm-hmm. Well, funnily enough, you mentioned Bill Still. He and I were both in Sweden. My book was translated into Swedish, and my publisher wanted a book tour, and so we both spoke he showed his movie, and then I spoke at a presentation in Sweden. And as it happened, it was in Sweden in 19... I know this because I was researching relevant things to Sweden. In 1971, the dollar went off the gold standard, and Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard because we didn't have the gold. And de Gaulle first recognized that when we were going heavily into debt with the Vietnam War, and so he cashed in all his dollars for gold. And then England tried to do the same thing, and then Nixon said, no, we don't have that much gold. I mean, we're going to go bankrupt if everybody cashes in their dollars. It was basically a run on the U.S. gold stash when the international central banks recognized that we didn't have enough gold to cover all our dollars that were out there. So they closed the gold window, and then there was this secret meeting of bankers in Sweden in 1974, figuring out how they were going to get back the power of the dollar, you know, which was backed by gold. and it became the reserve currency of the world, because up till then we had been good for it. We had the most gold of anybody after World War II, and that's why we could get away with saying our dollars are just as good as gold, and people were taking the dollars instead of the gold. So they got this idea that they would back it by oil. And so there was and it was Henry Kissinger, supposedly, who then went to the OPEC countries and said, we are going to make you very rich. We're going to quadruple the price of oil. But in return, you will sell your oil only in dollars, and you will put the dollars in our Wall Street banks and London banks. So that was the deal, and that was so for the next, let's see, 30 years, the dollar was indeed backed by oil, because everybody needed oil. They had to have the dollars to buy the oil, and because they didn't have that many dollar reserves, because nobody anticipated that oil was going to be so expensive all of a sudden, they had to borrow the dollars. And so that put everybody, all the countries, in debt to the Wall Street and London bankers. But then in 2000, Saddam Hussein was the first to break the deal, and he started accepting things other. He accepted euros for his oil, so that naturally had to be stopped. And then we got into a war with him, and then other countries started trading their oil and other things besides dollars as well. So now we're at the point of, now what are we going to back our dollar with? But
To go back to one of the points you made, I think it's an interesting sideline. Most people, I think, perceive that the oil crisis of 1973, in which the price of oil went from about $2.50 a barrel to over $10.50 a barrel, which was almost a factor of five increase. A lot of people blame that on the OPEC countries. But you are saying that, in fact, they were just simply responding to the dictates of Henry Kissinger and the kind of the bankers?
Yeah, well, that's actually, you know, the book, John Perkins' book?
Confessions of an Economic
Hitman.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, he says that in there. That,
okay.
Mm-hmm. So, and he was one of the hitmen, so he knows.
Yeah, right. So, yeah, this is, I mean, there's probably countless books in this country, textbooks, et cetera, which talk about the oil crisis of 1973 as being orchestrated by the OPEC countries. And I guess we're looking a little bit behind the curtain, like the Wizard of Oz, to hear John Perkins' side of the story, which is that OPEC did not do this unilaterally. They were responding to diplomatic pressure from some of our top politicians and bankers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it was done to strengthen the dollar, to back the dollar.
Okay.
So I've read.
And how's the dollar doing now, Ellen?
Well, it's still up there. You know what they did? The most recent thing they did was to trash the euro, which they did by trashing the Greek bond. It was reported in the Wall Street Journal in January that a group of speculators short sellers, and what was gold, George Soros' hedge fund and another number of other hedge funds got together at a sort of a social dinner and were discussing how to prop up the dollar. And they said, well, we've got to bring down the euro. And somebody proposed, well, the easiest thing to do would be to attack the Greek bond, which was the weakest link in the euro. And so that was published in the Wall Street Journal, and in that article it said no criminal charges have been brought or whatever. Apparently this is not illegal. And that very day, then the SEC sent letters to all the attendees at this meeting and said, you better keep notes of that meeting. So, I mean, they didn't actually prosecute, apparently, but there was clearly the suggestion that something shady had happened here. And then after that, all of a sudden, we never heard about sovereign debt before, really. And then all of a sudden, it's all over the news that there's this Greek crisis, and it's a big deal. And sure enough, the euro crashed, and that made the dollar stronger. And you know, China recently downgraded our debt, and nothing happened at all. Why? Because nobody made a big deal about it in the news. It only affects trading when it hits the news. You know, all the traders watch the news to see what's going on and what's being made of it. And if CNBC says, well, you know, the dollar was just downgraded, but we don't care, you know, we were not paying any attention, then nothing happened.
So the media then controls the value of our currencies as much as anything.
Right, and I would say that the media themselves are controlled.
By the bankers.
Well, yeah, by big money, and that is the bankers, who also control the government. So it's one big oligarchy.
Oligarchy or oligarchy?
Yeah, oligarchy.
Yeah.
So where does Wall Street tie into all of this? Do you? I've noticed that you, in some of your interviews that you do, you get into some of the workings behind that.
Well, it is interesting. The City of London, and then you have the old school bankers of Europe, the gnomes of Zurich, which would be the Bank for International Settlements, and then Wall Street, you tend to think more of Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. Well, even J.P. Morgan is sort of old school. So Goldman Sachs are the upstart speculator types that are taking banking in this sort of shocking derivatives in this new direction. So I've read this argument that they're like the titans, you know, the battle of two amoral groups fighting each other. So Wall Street sort of represents the new money, the new bankers, the young speculator bankers that are doing these high-frequency program trades and manipulating markets. And then the old-school bankers of Europe are trying to temper them. So they're the ones coming out with the increased capital requirements. And what that'll do is that'll tighten the money supply, which is going to create another depression. I mean, it's the very same thing they did in the 30s and in the 1890s, collapse the money supply. So,
well, obviously, this seems to be like a class warfare going on here,
yeah.
And yet there's also warfare among themselves, you know, who can outdo the other one. But then at the same time, it looks as though that they, you know, try to work in, you know, together. So it must be really something else to try to sit down and figure out their moves.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. It's like, of course, I'm a writer first and foremost, so I'm always looking for plot line here. I like to see the villains and the characters.
Well, you know, when we talked to Bill Still a couple weeks ago, he mentioned Iceland, which apparently is so deeply in debt. It's the debt that it owes is about 100% of its GDP or GNP. I don't know which one. But anyway, he thought maybe there was a window of hope there that they'd just throw off the shackles of the banking system maybe and do something different. Do you see there's a possibility for the Icelanders to set a positive precedent here?
Well, yes. I mean, that's what they too could set up a banking system where they could issue krona. I think is it krona? Is that their
currency? Yeah, that's
currency?
I know that's, yeah.
They could do the same thing where they could don't try to pay off their foreign debts with it, because that is where you wind up hyperinflating your currency. If you, like Germany 1923 or Argentina 2000. Or before 2001 when they collapsed their economy, or Zimbabwe when their currency collapsed, it was because they were printing Zimbabwe dollars and trying to buy U.S. dollars with them in order to pay off their loans to the IMF. Well, the speculators saw them coming, of course, and then they would jack up the price of the dollars, which meant the U.S. dollars, which meant the Zimbabwe dollar went down, down, down. It's because of this whole floating currency deal, which shouldn't even exist. I mean, it should be illegal that currencies compete with each other, because they should just be like yardsticks. They're a measure of value, and to have a currency collapse, the value is collapsing. That, and it hurts many people, all the people whose value is tied up in that currency. But anyway, that's a big mistake, to try to pay off a foreign debt owed in another currency by printing your own currency. That will turn into hyperinflation. But if you print your own currency to pay your own people, for your own workers and your own materials to get your economy going again, that will work. And it's, that's been demonstrated many times. You know, for hundreds of years, you can find many examples of this working. Like going back to the island state of Guernsey in the early 19th century, they owed heavy debts and they didn't have any money and the place was falling apart. They needed walls built and buildings built and stuff. And so they decided, well, they'll just issue their own currency just for those internal purposes of rebuilding the country. And they got all this stuff. They got to put the workers back to work, and they built all these things that they needed. And it cost them nothing. I mean, they did it with the credit of the country. And it didn't inflate prices. It didn't they didn't put the country into debt. And you know, it worked out really well. Benjamin Franklin's colony of Pennsylvania did the same thing.
Yeah, and you mentioned, or Melody mentioned in the introduction, that you had done some traveling in places like Guatemala and Nicaragua, et cetera. What's your observation about their plight? We know Guatemala, for instance, and Nicaragua are two of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. Can you give us a reason why that's the case? Are those people all just pathetic losers, or are they perhaps victimized by a system?
Yeah, I'm afraid they're victimized by us. Look at Mexico. They're totally rich in resources. They should be rich. Or look at Africa. They're totally rich in resources. Why are they so poor? Because of their resources. They've been exploited. But that's the thing. They don't have control of their own money supplies. So they could get back control, but they're little countries, and we the military will go in and make sure we're in control.
Well, when you say we, how would you explain the United States contribution, say, to the international debts of the World Bank and the IMF, which are these international money lending systems, which often then wind up keeping these third world countries in essentially a neo-colonial status.
Yeah.
What's the American role in that? Are we the bad guys, or is it some other entities that are the heavy-handed ones here?
Well, I shouldn't say we, because it's obviously not us. It's not you and me or the American people generally. We don't even know we're doing it, nor are we necessarily benefiting from it. But it is our bankers that are in control of that. So it's Wall Street, but who are they? I mean, they probably go back to European roots. It's not real clear who's pulling the strings here. But yeah, the U.S. is one of the dominant controllers of the IMF.
Could we look at, just for a minute, look at one country in Latin America and kind of sort out what has happened? Let's say Argentina, the poster child of neoliberal reforms.
Argentina is a great example, because they did what all these little countries should do, I think. In 2001, they stood up to the currency collapsed, and so they said, "We're broke. You know, go away. We're not going to pay." And then they started printing pesos, which is what they should do. They printed their own money, used it to get things going again, and the economy boomed. It was like 3 years later, I think it was growing at the rate of 7% a year. And all the advisors were saying, oh, no, you can't do it that. You have to have the foreign investors, and they won't invest if you don't pay your debts. You know, you got to pay your foreign debts. But so they said, no, we'll, you know, come back later. We got to get our country on its feet first. And so then in 2004, things were booming. And so they were printing all these pesos, getting the economy going again, and it did not create inflation until they hit full employment. And then it did start being inflationary. You know, that'll happen after you put everybody to work. Then if you keep adding more money, then and you're not adding goods and services, that will drive prices up. So what Kirchner did, who is the president, was to he actually controlled prices. You know, he did various regulatory things to hold prices down. But what they did wrong then, oh, I shouldn't say wrong, I don't know. But anyway, then they did pay off the creditors, and what they particularly wanted to do was to get rid of the IMF. So they paid off the IMF by borrowing from Venezuela at a relatively high interest rate. So now they're in debt to Venezuela. So they have the same problem they have. Now they're in debt again. You know, they're not in great shape right now. But for a number of years there, they proved the model that they could stand up to the creditors and not pay. I mean, they just did a debt moratorium. They didn't say they'll never pay, but they just said, we don't have the money now, come back later. And they turned their resources to their own country and got the thing going again. And they also did a number of other interesting things. At the local level, they had community currencies, a big community currency, the biggest community currency in the world at that time, I think in 2001, where they just printed little paper receipts and traded with each other, traded things with this community currency, because they just didn't have money, so they created their own money for their own products and services trade. The one problem with it was that these little paper notes were easily counterfeited, so the community eventually it sort of fell apart because of that. So that was one thing at the very local level, just the people themselves. And then the local governments, they didn't have any money to pay their workers. So what they did was they issued these IOUs. But they were nice, formal-looking IOUs that were good for a certain amount of the local currency. And so people accepted those and traded with each other in the IOUs. So the IOUs actually expanded the money supply. They were just like, it's just like if you paid people in bonds and then people started trading the bonds as if they were money, because they are money. You know, they're good for, they've got a value on them, and you know what it is you're getting. And then at the national level, they printed pesos, the actual pesos, and paid workers and materials. So that all worked, and any country could do that, and I think they should do that.
Let me go ahead and say this is KHEN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado. And I want to say the views expressed on this program are those of myself and of my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHEN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And this evening my co-host is Dr. Eric Carlstrom, and our special guest is Alan Brown, who's written the book The Web of Debt, and it's the shocking truth about our money system and how we can break free. And she's also an author of a number of other books. And I also wanted to kind of, you brought up something that's in your intro about the fact that your forbidden medicine, and it goes back to same corrupting forces that have captured the monetary system, was involved in that. Is there, I don't know if, I mean, it's kind of a little off subject here, but at the same time, I'm just wondering, is these guys, what you're saying here is that the same ones that control the monetary system probably control all the other systems?
Well, that was how I got into the whole money question. Was I was an attorney. I had several clients who were alternative practitioners and who had gotten in trouble for treating people with things that weren't FDA approved or whatever. You know, they were using natural alternative therapies, but they were just, it's not that they hurt anyone, any of their patients. It was that they weren't following the rules, which were that you had to only use, you know, drugs, chemotherapy, radiation and surgery, et cetera, and be an MD. So in the course of that, well, I represented Jimmy Keller, who was a cancer therapist in Tijuana, very popular, and he was arrested for the alleged fraud of saying that he had a cancer cure, although he didn't say it. It was somebody in Utah, and so it was called a conspiracy to commit fraud. It was the thinnest of charges, it seemed like to us, and they kidnapped him in Tijuana, took him from his clinic where he was practicing legally, and took him to Brownsville, Texas. Long story. But anyway, he was, one of his supporters was Ed Griffin, who not only wrote Creature from Jekyll Island, which is the more famous of his books, but wrote World Without Cancer, and there was a movie called World Without Cancer, and Jimmy showed that movie to all his patients. So I read the book, and it linked, it showed how the drug cartel, legal drugs, you know, the pharmaceutical cartel, which would be the Rockefeller-Morgan interests, and the banking cartel, again, the Rockefeller-Morgan interests, and the oil cartel, Rockefeller, were the same thing. And he traced it through World War II and the IG Farben chemical industries of Germany, which are also bankers, and, you know, they're all in cahoots. And so I realized from that that where they got their power was through the power to create money, which banks create all of our money today as debt, all of it except coins, which compose only 1/10,000th of the money supply. So I realized that if you were going to fix any of these problems, you had to address that fundamental problem, which was where our money comes from, and that we, the people, need to get that power back.
Where does the IMF and I think the other one is the World Bank, is where do they come into this? Are they central banks, or are they something else?
No, well, they're actually, the IMF has been called the collection agency for the banks, for the private banks. You know, if you have a debt to a private bank, you can default. Let's say you're a country and you have a debt to Deutsche Bank or some big bank, you can default. But if you have a debt to the IMF, I mean, those are the people you don't want to have a debt to. If the IMF takes over the debt, then, or in other words, lends you money so that you can get out of your other debts, then now the IMF is going to do much more onerous things than, it's going to be a lot worse than just a default on your record, because the IMF will do a lot of arm twisting, and they force countries to cut back on services, raise taxes. You know, it just squeezes the middle and lower classes for the benefit of the wealthy, of the bankers.
Yeah, these are called structural adjustment programs,
yeah.
And the kind of the package of IMF-imposed structural adjustment programs, or SAPs, are almost always the same, and I think they're imposed on about 160 countries of the world right now, increasingly including the United States. And if the IMF has you in debt, then it'll say, okay, listen, you're going to have to reorganize your economy so that you sell off your public sector industries and your utilities and whatnot, to privatize them, sell them off to the highest bidder, international, multinational corporations. You're going to have to lower the value of your currency relative to the dollar. You're going to have to restrict the lending policies to small businesses so that they have very high interest rates. There's a whole series you're going to have to lower the value of your currency, like I say, relative to the dollar, so you can go to Guatemala and Mexico and your dollar goes a long way. Well, these are kind of the standard package of adjustments that the IMF imposes that keeps these third world countries in basically neo-colonial status so that their labor and their resources can be purchased very cheaply on the international market and can be supplied then to these multinationals.
So are the same people involved in the IMF that are involved in the City of London or the Federal Reserve?
I'll leave that to Eric because I'm losing my voice. Go ahead.
Well, I'd be interested to hear what you say, Ellen, but
I did have a question for you. You said that they raise the interest rates on the small businesses. I wasn't aware of that. What's the logic of that?
Well, the logic is that it's very tough for small businessmen in these third world countries to compete with the multinationals because because they, you know, it's the example of, you mentioned of Lincoln. You know, he wanted to win the Civil War, and the European bankers said, yeah, we'll loan you money, 25% interest. In other words, we're going to help you lose the war, you know.
Uh-huh. But what's the justification? They must have some argument for why this is good for the country.
Well, no, it's not good for the country. It's good for the multinational corporations. And all of these IMF, this... this neoliberal reforms and this Washington consensus, the golden straitjacket, all these terms refer to the same kinds of policies of the IMF, and they make it impossible for these third world countries to get back on their feet. So, you know, the whole push after World War II, especially for many countries, was to, you know, to write a constitution and get independent of their colonial, slave masters, and these economic arrangements have kept them from being able to really do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a new kind of slavery. It's economic slavery, and this, of course, is what John Perkins' book is about as well, the Confessions of an Economic Hitman, how the American Empire was extended through economic arrangements as much and perhaps even more than military arrangements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I was just wondering, though, I mean, I could see their argument, at least, for making all these countries tighten their belts and lay government workers off, cut back on services, because the argument is that the country is too much in debt and you want to pay off your debt and,
right,
you know, pay off your creditors. But I don't see how raising the interest rates on small business even fits into that logic argument. I mean, why are they claiming that that's something that the country should do in order to pay off its debt?
Well, I don't know why they're claiming it, but that's, in practice, that's what they do, and it keeps the small farmers and the small businessmen,
yeah,
from being able to compete with the larger economic,
yeah,
forces.
Well, I can definitely see that. I was just in Michigan, and the banking commissioner, the Michigan banking commissioner, I read, was complaining that the way these capital requirements are structured, they're squeezing out the small banks, which are the ones, you know, the local banks, which are the ones that are lending to the local businesses, the small businesses. So it's the same deal where they're squeezing out the small businesses, but they're serving the bigger getting bigger and the small are getting squeezed out.
Yeah.
Well, this is happening on many levels in all aspects of the economy. But I was curious, going back again to the IMF, are we a member of the IMF?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, now...
A founding member and a major member. Well, the member, the voting, I think I'm right in this, that the voting goes according to how much money you put into it. And obviously, we put the most money into it. Anyway, I think that's it. But anyway, we definitely have a major controlling interest in the IMF.
Yeah, well, let me just say a little bit about that. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund were established, I believe, in 1944 at the Bretton Woods, mm-hmm, Conference in New Hampshire, right at the close of World War II. And the idea was, okay, we're going to set up the rules for economic activity post-World War II. And this was, there were two individuals who wrote the rules, and one was British, John Maynard Keynes, and the other was American, Harry Dexter White. And they set up the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the Bank for International Settlements, etc. And they basically structured the post-World War II economic reality such that the IMF is... it's an international bank, but it has many, many, many banks that are members. And so I think the largest number of banks that are members of the IMF are, in fact, American banks. So that American banks control maybe 15% or maybe more of all of the IMF activity. They're all comprised of central bankers and central banks.
So is any one of these three, the World Bank, IMF, or the Bank for International Settlements, any one of them any more powerful than the other, or are they working in concert in some way?
I think they're sort of competing with each other at the moment for being the head. The Bank for International Settlements has the Financial Stability Board, which the G20 has appointed as setting the rules globally for banks, economic policy, which is alarming that we've given that power over to this group of bankers in Switzerland to set our policies. They can peer into what we're doing and disapprove of what we're doing. And it was all done on a handshake. That should be a treaty. So it should have been a two-thirds vote of the Senate, and then you'd have people talking about it, and people would be aware of what we just gave away. But instead, all this stuff is happening at the G20, where they're just behind closed, you know, they're talking and they come to some agreements, and we, the voters, and even Congress has no say in it. So they've got the Financial Stability Board. Well, the IMF, meanwhile, was just at the G20 in Pittsburgh a year ago, was given the power to issue, I think it was $300 billion in SDRs, special drawing rights, and they, let me see if I got this right, it was $500 billion that they were going to be able to make loans. They were given additional money to make loans, so to poorer countries, I guess, and $300 billion in these SDRs, special drawing rights, which was supposed to be a global currency that would substitute for the dollar as global currency to give us a chance to work out our problems, which meant basically to collapse our currency, you know, to devalue the dollar and deal with our debt or whatever, because we're no longer strong enough to be the reserve currency. But then I saw that some Fed heads, you know, heads of the Fed branches said, no, we're not going to, we're going to try to maintain the dollar as the reserve currency. So they're all kind of still arguing among themselves about who's got control here. But the movement, the direction of all that is that they are attempting to set up a global regulatory system where all countries have to borrow from this private entity of, you know, banking collective. They're something that they issue, these SDRs. So we would no longer have control over, basically over our own currency. And so that's why that's what my main message and what I keep trying to make people understand is that we still, not all countries do, but we still have the power to issue our own money and to issue our own credit, and we've got to maintain that. That is where we get the power to run our own country and run our own economy. And as soon as we give that away, like the EU countries have given it away, we will no longer be sovereign. And that's when the bankers do get control. I mean, they do have control of the U.S. too, because even though we have the power, we don't exercise it. The government does not issue our currency. The Federal Reserve issues it. And then they lend it to the banks, and then the banks lend it to us and charge us interest on it.
Well, in a sense, haven't we been under the same type of an influence like the John Perkins was doing to some of these third world countries, and we have given over our ability to support ourselves so that we become a part of this through, you know, sending our economy over to other countries, our ability to produce, and that's, and I find it kind of interesting that if we're a part of this and we're collapsing our own country in economically, we some of these people are where do their allegiances lie here? Am I? Are you following what I'm saying?
I'm not sure of the question.
Okay. All right. What I'm trying to say is who's in? That's why I was asking earlier about who's in these IMF and the like. Because at one point here we are, like
all countries are supposedly in it.
Okay.
It's attempting to be on its surface, it's a democratic institution, but it's really not, and it's certainly not who we want controlling our economic policy.
And so,
well, again, going back to Bill Still and his movie, The Money Masters, and then his more recent one, The Secret of Oz, especially The Money Masters traces the history of money, and it really talks about what's happened since World War II with the IMF and the World Bank and the Bank of International Settlements. These international financial agreements, yeah, this is a long, long-term project, I think, of these individuals to get complete mm-hmm. control of the world resources and the world economy. This is, you know, the special drawing rights. I mean, these were. This whole idea was formulated back in 1944, and the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, you know, goes back to these These are the ideas they couldn't implement back after World War II there, but they've wanted to for decades. Well, let me just go over the standard features of these structural adjustment programs here. The IMF tells this third world country that's in debt, it says, okay, you've got to devalue your currency, you've got to create higher interest rates for your local people, you have to have strict control of the money supply, you have to cut government spending on social services like schools and health care and Social Security, you have to remove trade and exchange controls like tariffs, so quote-unquote open your borders for free trade, which of course is not free at all. You have to use market forces to set the price of goods, services, and labor. You have to privatize public sector enterprises such as water systems, forests, healthcare systems, etc. You have to promote exports. So all of these together then make it easy for the international corporations to come in and just take over and get your resources and your labor cheap. So first world elites then profit and the third world country stays with 70% poverty rates such as we have in Mexico, or 80% as in the case of Venezuela, etc. So these international banking agreements or economic arrangements then make sure you don't have a middle class, but rather you have an extreme wealthy upper class, and then you have a class of serfs and slaves. So we have a whole series of economic arrangements that have been designed to maintain this incredible class disparity. All of this is based on the power to print the money out of nothing, as you say, Ellen. And one point that I wanted to bring up when you're talking about how banks can expand and contract the currency, that maybe is a little bit hard for people to imagine. But going back to the Money Masters movie, the point is made by Bill Still that in the 20s, the Roaring 20s, when there were good times in America, the bankers printed more money. And then in the 30s, when there were terribly tough times, the bankers called in the money, and there was less money in circulation. So simply by printing more money or destroying more notes and printing less money, the bankers can cause booms and busts. And they have done this, and they continue to do that. And their control is so absolute, most people don't know what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And printing money, of course, is just I can't think of the word, but like a symbolic term. That's not really what they do. It's not that the printing presses are literally rolling, not like in 1923 Germany. It's that they're creating credit on their books. That's where the printed money in our money supply is only 3% of the money supply. 97% is bank credit. So it's all just created. If you go to it's initiated as a loan. So let's say you go to the bank and you want to borrow $500,000 to buy a house. So they will write that, they'll take your mortgage. You'll sign this piece of paper called the mortgage, which is your promise to pay. So that's their they call that an asset to themselves because it's going to pay them money over time. So they write that on one side of their books as an asset. And then they write that sum into your account. You've now got $500,000 in your account, and you can write checks on that, and you can see it online. But nobody printed any paper here. It's just online. You now have $500,000, and so the bank writes that as a liability to itself on the other side of its books because you have now have the ability to write checks on that account, and when the checks go out, the bank will have to come up with the money. So, and what they do, in the 30s, banks quit. They were so suspicious of each other that they wouldn't honor each other's checks. That was back when the checks actually represented gold, and they didn't think the banks really had the gold, which, of course, they didn't. So to reestablish confidence in the banking system, the Federal Reserve set up this clearing system where the banks had to hold reserves at the Federal Reserve. So they had to have 10% of their outstanding loans. They had to have reserves of 10%. And so then when the checks would clear, they would run through that reserve pool. So in a way, it's the money of the depositors comes in and goes into the reserve pool. And then when somebody's check goes out, then they pull money out of the reserve pool. So they have to fill the reserve pool up again. So it looks like you just borrowed the money of the depositor. But you really didn't, because Mr. Smith's check that he just deposited in his account is still in his account. Mr. Smith is never told, you can't have your money because we just gave it to Mr. Jones. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, one of the interesting things that you brought out is how that 10% came to be for the reserve.
Oh, yeah, that they just figured by trial and error that people only came for their gold 10% of the time.
But what were you saying, Ellen, about the Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones?
Oh, well, back in, you know, in It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart, Mr. Smith's check really was, or Mr. Smith's money really was borrowed by Mr. Jones, and that was a savings and loan. That was not the regular banking situation. That was the savings and loan situation. And that didn't work, and that's when you had the runs on the banks and stuff, because the money just wasn't there. There wasn't enough money for both Mr. Smith and Mr. Jones to have the same money at the same time. But under the reserve system, there always is enough money, because the bank has to maintain this pool, and the check's going out, or the money's pulled out of that pool. And then if the depositor comes for his money, the bank has to fill the pool up so that the depositor's money's going to be there. They're only going to come like 10% of their time. They know that. But if, for some reason, the bank doesn't have the money to cover, they have 2 weeks. There's a two-week window where they have to make their books balance. So if at the end of the two-week period, they don't have the money, then they borrow it. So they can borrow from the other banks. Currently, they can borrow from the other banks at 0.2%. Like, they almost get the money for free. That's the Fed funds rate, which the Federal Reserve is purposely keeping very, very low so that they can afford the interest on this debt that they just increased by 50%, the federal debt.
So the waiting time that they have on your checks has something to do with this, what you just spoke of then. So in case that if the bank is possibly insolvent or whatever, they give themselves that two-week waiting period before they have to make good on it.
Yeah, I cashed a large check recently at my small bank, which did indeed go bankrupt after that, and they told me it was going to be 2 weeks before it cleared, and it was a check from myself to myself. It was very, you know, it's from one bank to another, my own accounts. But so, obviously, they had the money. That wasn't it. It wasn't that it took 2 weeks to figure out whether the other bank had the money. It was that they had to refill their pool. Yeah.
Well, Ellen, perhaps now would be a good time, if you wouldn't mind, to explain to us, kind of in simple terms, what happened in 2008 for the financial crisis in this country and where we are now vis-a-vis that crisis.
Well, in 2008, it started in early 2008 when the monoline insurers, these were the insurers that were insuring credit default swaps. They were called monoline because they only insured one thing. They weren't insuring cars or anything. They were just insuring default. And they they didn't have the money. When they, like everybody, they were gambling that housing would always go up, that it would never go down, which was obviously not true. But they were just gambling that they could get out before the whole thing collapsed. So it was discovered, they were determined that these monoline insurers, AmBac and MBIA, didn't have the money to pay up on this widespread housing default that was now starting to occur. And so that meant these insurance agencies, because they were supposedly guaranteeing this debt, all these different bonds and stuff were rated AAA. Well, suddenly, because the monoline insurers themselves were no longer AAA, then all the debt that they had been insuring was no longer AAA. So that was when there was this panic and this starting to collapse of these collateralized debt obligations, et cetera. And Bear Stearns was a big trader in derivatives and collateralized debt obligations, or mortgage-backed securities wrapped in a derivative. That gets a bit complicated. But anyway, Bear Stearns was a big player in this. And so that was when J.P. Morgan bought out Bear Stearns with money from the Federal Reserve, and actually with Bear Stearns' own collateral. I mean, the reason they qualified for the loan was because of Bear Stearns' own collateral. So Bear Stearns could have gotten the loan itself, but the Fed wouldn't give Bear Stearns the loan, but they would give the loan to J.P. Morgan. I mean, it was very fishy how all that happened. But meanwhile, after Bear Stearns collapsed, Henry Paulson and Ben Bernanke were agitating, trying to get Congress to do a bailout, and Congress wouldn't do it. They just didn't think it was a big deal, you know, that important, or they just couldn't get it together to do it. So then in September, you could make a case, which I have made this case in articles, and I have a PowerPoint to this effect, that they had to let somebody collapse in order to... They needed a scapegoat, you know, one victim that would go down and would show what a big disaster this would be if any of these big banks went down. Well, that was Lehman Brothers. So Lehman Brothers went down, and you could show that it was actually brought down there several days before. Well, funnily enough, it was September 11th, 2008, was when the stock market was when the Lehman stock was heavily, heavily naked short sold. So that's really when it collapsed, when the stock collapsed. And then on September 15th, they declared bankruptcy. And over the weekend, there was a scramble to try to get somebody to buy it. But the Fed didn't step up and offer to bail it out, and the Treasury didn't offer to bail it out, as they did offer, you know, they did with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and they did with AIG a day later. But with Lehman Brothers, they let it go. There were negotiations for a British bank to buy it. I think it was Barclays Bank. But then Gordon Brown's Chancellor of the Exchequer stepped in and said, no, we're not going to let that happen because we have some rule that says the voters have to vote or something. So that fell through. Anyway, you could argue that it was made to collapse in order to shake up the market. So on September 15th, you have the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers. The market goes down. And then on September 16th, AIG was bailed out, actually bought out by the Federal Reserve for $85 billion. And Goldman Sachs was given $13 billion, et cetera. All the creditors were paid off in full, which they shouldn't have been. So AIG was bailed out, and the market started going back up. Well, so they hadn't done enough damage. So on the 17th, there was this another heavy, heavy naked short selling, which is illegal, selling stock you don't own and never covering. That also gets a bit complicated. But anyway, you can show that there was intentional manipulation of the market on the 17th, and then on the 18th, there was this massive run on the money market. According to Paul Kanjorski, who testified on or spoke on C-SPAN in February, the following February, he said it's a misconception that the bailout was all about saving the homeowners. That Henry Paulson went to Congress and said that there had been a $550 billion run on the money markets in the space of a couple of hours on the 18th, and that if this weren't stopped, that the whole economy would collapse, which you can make a case if it were going at that rate, it would collapse. The importance of the money markets is, as I said, was started to say when if banks make loans and they don't actually have the money to cover the loan, then they borrow it. So they borrow from each other. So it's very important to the banks to be able to borrow from each other cheaply. And if they can't, then the whole credit, that all of credit just dries up. And money markets are also how many businesses operate on a credit line, or in other words, they borrow the money first, pay their workers, make the thing that they make, and then sell it, and then pay off the loan, you know. So they're always running on borrowed money, and that's the money market money, that very, very liquid money.
It kind of appears to me that there's a lot of money to be made in bankruptcies. And it's as though they set these businesses up to fail and then reinvent themselves. banks or you know, whatever. But how does one protect oneself from it when you have a country like maybe Argentina that they seem to kind of go in there, you know, every few 20 years or so and collapse the whole system? And it's like they're set up to fall. And that seems to be what's going on with this country, is we're being set up to fail.
Yeah, well, that's why I keep agitating and saying we do not, you know, the IMF is now telling us that we need to clean up our act. We haven't even borrowed from the IMF, so who are they to tell us what to do about our debt? So what I keep trying to say is that we are still sovereign, and we issue the dollars that our debt is owed in, so we can pay off our dollar. We can pay off our debt in dollars. I just read Richard Russell. He's an older, you know, wizened investment advisor, and he was saying that that the debt has gotten out of hand. It went up by 50% since 2006, the federal debt, and that there are only two choices. Either we obviously can't pay it off. The one choice is to pay it off, and that won't happen, he says. So the other choice is to, one choice is to default, he says. But we never default. We always pay our debt. And the other is to dilute our way out of it. In other words, inflate the currency and make so the debt becomes less expensive. But I would say there are options three and four. Number three would be just carry the debt. We've carried it for 200 years. We haven't paid off our debt for 200 years. It just keeps going up and up and up. And no great disaster has befallen. The only issue is whether we can carry the interest. You know, you can always just keep rolling over the debt. It's whether you can pay the interest. But the interest bill is the same now as it was in 2006. And that's because the interest rate has been dropped practically to zero. But the Japanese have had an interest rate of zero for practically a decade, I think, and they're still going. I mean, they haven't defaulted on their debt anyway. So that's one option. But the better option, I think, and everybody gives me a lot of, every time I bring this up, I know I'll get all kinds of, I take a lot of grief for saying so, but I think that the real solution here is to pay the debt. Everybody says we can't pay the debt because then we'll hyperinflate. But here's what I think you should do. Take all those pink pieces of paper that are called bonds, rip them up, and replace them with green pieces of paper that are called dollars. That's what we should have done in the first place, was issue dollars instead of issuing bonds. Because our entire money supply, M3, is debt, it all comes from debt. It's based on debt. Debt is our money supply. If you take one form of debt, which is a bond, and replace it with another form of obligation of the country, you know, a paper dollar is still, it just says that you're entitled to a dollar's worth of goods and services in our economy. Come and spend it. So if you replaced all the bonds with dollars, the money supply is going to be the same. And most of those bonds are held, everybody thinks the Chinese is a big deal, but they only hold $700 billion worth of debt. And the debt is $14 trillion. Most of the debt, 85% of it, is held by Americans, and 50% of it is held by the federal government itself. Like, Social Security is the biggest holder. Well, we're paying this debt to ourselves.
That's what I've heard, that we're much more wealthy than it's just a paper transaction than what appears to be.
So pay off the debt that we owe to Social Security with dollars. Turn that into dollars. That's not going to inflate. Social Security's not going to go out and spend the money. It's not like they're big shoppers, you know, and suddenly they've got this windfall money and they're going to go spend it and drive up prices. They're going to use the money for the same thing they were going to use it for anyway, which is to pay when somebody's Social Security is due. Or the central banks, they're holding a lot of the debt, and they're holding it to protect their currency against attack from speculators. You know, they need the reserves. So if you switch their bonds for dollars, they're still going to hold them. They're not going to come spend them. They still need the reserves. In fact, they hold a lot of their reserves in dollars. It's either dollars or bonds. But even if, let's say hypothetically, we paid off the Chinese their $700 billion and they decided to spend some of that money in the U.S., so good. We need that money. We need somebody spending some money. People here aren't spending money because they don't have it to spend. Somebody's got to get the economy going again. And if you get a little liquidity out there, maybe that you could buy some products. People are worried about the Chinese buying, like, the harbors and the bridges and all that, but we don't have to sell them our harbors and bridges. We can put limits on what they can buy. Just sell them products.
Well, let me ask you this. You say pay off the debt. Are you speaking of having the government print the money interest-free and then pay off the debt?
Yeah, I am. But call in the bond. See, that's the difference. When the Fed pays the debt, the bond is still out there. You know, they... Let me think. Maybe I've written this, but now I'm not following my own train of thought. But anyway, yeah, just actually call in the bonds and replace them. Just change the color of the paper. That's what I'm talking about.
Well, now,
and you're
going to
have
money...
the same amount of paper out there.
Okay. Is the money supply being contracted now?
Yes. It's not being... Well, it is. It is contracting at the rate of 10% a year, I think I read, for the first quarter of this year. But what collapsed the money supply, the M3 money supply, this is all these various forms of accounting entry money, it's not paper money, is that in 2000, when the, well, it was the summer of 2007 when you had the two Bear Stearns hedge funds that went bankrupt, and then the collateralized debt obligation market collapsed because everybody got nervous about these bundles of mortgages that were wrapped, supposedly protected with the derivative, but they weren't really protected. And when people realized these weren't AAA investments after all, they quit buying them. So those, well, the banks would take their mortgages, wrap them up into these securities, and sell them off to investors. And those were the things that the investors quit buying. But when they were selling them off to investors, that made room on the bank's books for more debt, and then more debt, and then more debt. And all of our debt, of course, is money. That's where our money comes from. So the banks were able to leverage. They were able to issue many times more debt than they can issue now because the debt was being taken off their books, and then they could use the same capital. Like right now the capital requirement is 8%. So let's say you had $8 of capital. You could make $100 in loans. Bundle those up into securities, sell them off to investors. Then you can make another $100 in loans. Bundle those up, sell them off, et cetera, et cetera. So when the investors quit buying, the bank could have $8 in capital. They can make $100 in loans, and that's it. That was all they could make until the loan got paid off. So suddenly the amount of debt out there, which meant the amount of money out there, a collapse. And so the money wasn't there to buy products, and therefore people laid off workers. And that's what's called started this whole spiral of unemployment and businesses closing their doors.
Are you familiar at all with the Walter Burian's theory on what's going
on?
And what do you feel about that one?
Well, what interests me about it is there are definitely these big pools of money that the government has stashed away. And I was speaking I was invited to give a talk at a Government Finance Officers Association conference in Missouri. And so I asked those people, you know, what were all those pools of money that they all had? And they said they were effectively rainy day funds, that because municipal governments do not have the power to, they don't have credit lines. So sometimes it would happen where it had actually happened where they would miss budget how much money they needed. And, of course, they can only get money by going to the taxpayers and doing a bond issue and raising the money. So if they hadn't calculated their budget right, the whole city would come to a standstill until they could do another bond issue, and maybe the voters wouldn't approve. And if they could find anybody to borrow from at all, it would be at a very high interest rate. So to avoid that, they pack away. The one woman said her boss made her keep 80% extra. So they had to have 80% more than they really needed to run the city, just socked away in a fund, drawing a little bit of interest. And another man said, oh, no, that was excessive, that he kept 25%. But even 25%, that's a lot of extra money, and that stuff's just sitting there drawing interest. So what interests me is that you could use that money as the capital base for a publicly owned bank, which is what I think the solution is here. We should have state-owned banks like North Dakota does. And then people say, well, where are you going to get the capital? But they've got all the states have all these funds tucked around that have all kinds of money that's not being used, and they could hit up that money, use it for capital, and then you don't spend it. That's it. It's like even pension money. You need that money for the pensions, but you're not going to spend it. You're just going to invest it as the capital in your state bank. And then you can use that, say, $8 of capital to make $100 in loans. So you can make loans for projects, all kinds of infrastructure like here in California, we could have a high-speed train from L.A. to San Francisco, say. You could do all those things that would put people back to work. It would give us all that type of infrastructure that we used to have. We used to be so good at it here in California. You could even make loans to yourself. Like if you went over budget, you can draw from your own bank interest-free. I mean, you could pay interest, but because you own the bank, you get to keep the interest. In North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota pays the state a dividend of 25%. I mean, it's a huge return. So they're a big moneymaker for the state. And so instead of the state paying Wall Street banks, putting their money, the state's money goes into the Wall Street banks at some minuscule interest rate, and then the Wall Street banks use it to leverage into many times at some loans, and they don't even lend it back to the states. You know, they're speculating with it. Instead of that, use the have your own bank, which is paying you a 25% dividend. You know, they're paying money to the state, reducing taxes, and you can borrow from your own bank. You can use that bank to fund all kinds of projects, and it depends on the model. But there's some. Well, in Australia, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia actually made commercial loans. So they actually lent to homeowners at a very low interest rate, forcing the other banks to compete with them. So the other banks had to make low interest loans as well.
So what it appears to me is it's a re-education system beginning with an education and re-education on how the monetary system works, and to realize that if we're not paying attention, they're going to flim-flam us out of the money and do all these different transactions when we've really got the money here under our control if we are paying attention. Am I stating that correctly?
Right, it's been usurped from us. I did see recently that 40% of the GDP, I think that was it, 40% of the GDP is the financial sector. Well, what do they produce? Nothing. So that means 40% of the of our economy is parasites that are just drawing. I mean, they're parasites. That's what they do. Is they're middlemen, you know, that are drawing money out of the system.
Well, when we talked to Bill Still, he suggested that maybe Jerry Brown understands some of these concepts. Do you see any light in California that maybe that there's a way to turn the situation around, that there's a will, that there's the knowledge, or anything like that?
Well, it's funny you mentioned Jerry Brown, but I probably shouldn't say yet. But yes, we do have somebody who is talking to him now because he has expressed interest.
And of course, he may be the Democratic candidate for governor, and if he wins, then the state of California may go in another direction. Right now, I guess it's $19 billion in debt. It's not allowed, for some reason, to borrow the money to pay back that debt, although it did that back in the early 2000s to pay off Enron and the other energy companies that bilked our state of some $40 billion. At that time, under Gray Davis, California was allowed to borrow from banks to pay back the energy thieves. But for whatever reason now, California is not allowed to borrow the money to pay back the debt. So therefore, we have to cut back education and welfare and all this social sector stuff, just like a third world country does when it's subjected to structural adjustment programs from the International Monetary Fund.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I think in North Dakota, when they had such a problem, when they did a few years ago, they did fail to meet their budget, and they borrowed from their own State Bank. And, of course, it was interest-free because they owned the bank. So it was a loan that tided them over until they could make more money. But in California, for example, you could, if you had your own state bank then, you could lend the money to pay the teachers, that let's particularly say higher education, where that actually draws tuition, then the tuition, so you're making money with this. It's an investment that makes money, returns money. The tuition would go back and pay off the loan. So what you're doing is you start with the credit goes out into the economy, and that's what credit is. You know, it's the trust of the community to that it can be, that the loan can be paid off with the proceeds of the thing that's created. But I've heard even things that don't directly, well, for one thing, if you have your own bank, you can make interest-free loans for government projects. And if you take the interest out, you cut the cost of government projects on average by 50%.
Oh my goodness!
So things that look like they aren't sustainable, like alternative energy, suddenly become sustainable because you cut the cost of it in half. But even things that don't appear to be cost-effective in the sense that, say, education, well, say elementary school or education or something where nobody's paying for it, or medical care or Social Security, those things don't directly pay back. But you can, I've seen models where indirectly they actually do sustain the economy. You know, they do cause the economy as a whole to pay back. For instance, the good example is the GI Bill was supposedly one of the most cost-effective things that the federal government ever did, even though they put these soldiers through school, higher education, that didn't pay back directly. It's not like it was a product that would pay back the loan. But over the next 40 years, those soldiers then got higher-paying jobs than they would have otherwise because now they're trained. And so they paid more taxes. So in the next 40 years, the amount of taxes they paid for their schooling many times over.
Now, when you say more taxes, now don't you need to kind of differentiate between income tax and property and other types of taxes? Because the income tax goes to the Federal Reserve, which takes it out of the country, correct?
Yeah. I think I hear a static right now.
Yeah, and I'm not quite sure where that's coming from either. You there, Eric? Maybe Eric's off here. Let me go ahead and redial you here for the last few minutes here. And,
yeah, okay.
And I'll play a song. If I can.
Okay, yeah, so there are different types of taxes, but in that particular example of the GI Bill, every form of tax.
Oh, okay.
Okay. In that particular example of the GI Bill, every form of tax, they would pay more taxes across the board. I mean, they might buy more expensive houses, so they pay higher real estate taxes. They might, they'd earn more income, so they'd pay more in the way of income taxes. And they'd buy more products, so they'd pay more sales taxes.
Okay. Eric, are you still there? So that must have been something that dropped him.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I would go ahead and dial him back, but we're getting close to the end of the program anyways, and you do kind of like to stress the North Dakota banking is a good model to change to for our system, correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, I just think we have to get back the power to create our own money and the power to create our own credit. And North Dakota has done that in a very low-keyed sort of way. They haven't drawn attention to themselves, but they've had their own bank ever since 1919. But they've proved the model in the sense that they're the only state right now that has a budget surplus. They're in the position of, they're trying to figure out what to do with this extra money. Should they cut taxes? Should they add programs? I mean, nobody else is in that position. They also have the lowest default rate in the country, and they have the lowest unemployment rate in the country. So everything is working for them. They basically escaped the whole credit crisis that the other states are dealing with, and I believe it's because they have their own source of credit through their own own state-owned bank. But you could do it at even a smaller level. And of course, a lot of people are working on community currencies. But there are various ways to get back the money power. But what we just want to avoid doing, we definitely want to avoid giving it away to Europe, you know, to some controlling body in Europe that's going to dictate to us our policies. We need to, as a sovereign country, we need to issue our own money, pay our own debts in our own money. I mean, I think we should just issue the money. That's what money is. It's a representation of an obligation. It's the same as a debt. It's like, here's a dollar. We acknowledge that you did a dollar's worth of work. We owe you a dollar, so here's the dollar showing that we owe you a dollar, and you can take that piece of paper and go out and spend it. That's what money is. So what's the difference whether I give you a pink piece of paper and call it a bond and say, here, I owe you a dollar, or whether I just give you the dollar and say, here's the dollar, go spend it.
How much do you think it's costing us by having these entities involved in our system? Do you have you ever sat down and figured that out?
Sorry, what do you mean, entities?
Is like your Federal Reserve and our inability to print our own money.
Well, I was saying that 40% of the 40% of the GDP is the financial sector.
So you're saying that's.
So I'd say it would cost us 40% of our GDP right now.
Okay, and most, my understanding is our taxes go to the Federal Reserve. So.
No, actually, that's a misnomer.
Okay.
Because they used to. Actually, the income tax was set up in order to have a source of funds to pay the interest that was going to be due on this money that J.P. Morgan, who, you know, was headed the committee that got the Federal Reserve Act passed, that they were going to collect, that the Morgan Rockefeller syndicate was going to collect all this money for after issuing, they would issue our dollars and charge us interest on them. But, as I said, in the 60s, Wright Patman figured that out and basically forced them to agree to rebate the interest after deducting their costs. So to the extent that the Federal Reserve holds our bonds, that's actually the cheapest way we can get money, is to borrow from the Federal Reserve. But we don't borrow from the Federal Reserve. You know, just recently, a year ago, the Fed funded $200 billion in bonds, and that was unusual. That's not normally done, and it created a ruckus. The Chinese said, we hope you are not planning to monetize your debt, et cetera. So there was all this peering closely at what we were doing, as if we were inflating our money supply by borrowing it from our own Fed. So normally we don't borrow from the Fed. That they issue the bonds at auction, and they're sold off. So the illusion is that they're bought by people who already have the money. In other words, and of course that's certainly true for your grandmothers who bought Liberty bonds, you know, for their $25 or whatever. But most of the bonds are not bought by people with their own money. That's not. The bonds are largely, ultimately, all the money comes from banks because that's where all our money comes from. So ultimately, it's a debt to banks. And the banks do charge money. Do charge interest. The Federal Reserve doesn't because they were forced to give up that interest. But the other banks do.
Well, I don't know how else to end this program because it's about time to bring it to a close here, and I wish our co-host was still here to say his thanks for coming on and being a...
Yeah, I enjoyed his contribution.
Yes, and I really hope that maybe we can again do this, maybe brush up on some of your other books that you've written, or if you come out with a new one. Do you have another one in the works? Or?
Well, I would like to do a follow-up to Web of Debt because so many things have happened in the last 3 years. Plus, there were some things, you know, I just couldn't cover everything. Even though it's a long book, I just couldn't. There are other avenues to explore. So.
Mm-hmm. And I want to.
But my problem is, I get so caught up with writing articles. You know, I read something and I think, no, that's not the way it is. I have to set the record straight here. So I'm always feeling compelled to write yet another article. So I do have a little trouble getting to this book that I want to write.
Well, you do have a number of articles that you follow, and you write for primarily what publications?
Well, my articles get posted quite a few places, but they're usually in the Huffington Post and Truth Out and Global Research, things like that.
And your website is?
www.webofdebt.com.
And again, Ellen, I want to thank you very much for coming on the program, and I hope we can do this again.
Okay, thank you, Melody.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Bye.